All right, well, we are here today to talk about essentially writing efficient algorithms. That's one way to think about it. And, of course, a very special guest, Stefan T. Lowell-Wade. You've all met him before. He is Mr. STL, literally.
Yes. Excellent. That's how I sign my mails.
Perfect. So let's talk a little bit about, usually when you think about native code, one could argue that some people will target native code or to compose in native code, C++, C, to create efficient algorithms.
Oh, yeah. I mean, honestly, if you look at like C and C++, they're terrible languages. They're in fact so terrible that no one would use them if they weren't so darn effective at what they do. They're fast, and they allow the creation of extremely large programs with very good abstractions. So in order to get to that efficiency and the ability to write really, really large programs that don't fall over, that's why we all put up with, you know, C and C++'s quirks that we're all so used to. I mean, otherwise, why would we be using these languages?
I don't
know. So that's sort of their niche.
Cool.
Yeah.
And so let's talk about, and I'm going to probably just want to hand this off to you, and then you can teach us today maybe some of the, you know, core things you've done over the past couple months or 6 months or whatever.
A couple years.
Where you had to really kind of get things as efficient as possible and really kind of think about your algorithms a little bit more deeply than perhaps some will do just to bust out a web page or a line of business app in a quick amount of time using really good tools, but way abstract. So take it away, STL.
So, so my job is kind of interesting because I work on the C++ standard library. And we recently sent out on our VC blog, our developer blog, a survey that a bunch of people took asking, hey, you know, what libraries do you use in addition to other things like, you know, what's your type of application, blah, blah, blah. And I recently saw at one of our all-hands meetings just a graph of the responses that we got. And it was actually pretty funny. There was like maybe a dozen to like 15 options that people could select. And they could select more than one type of library that they were using. And so we had like Boost and Qt and STL and ATL and OFC. And I was very surprised to see that Boost, which is an open source library, had the longest bar, by far the most people saying that they were using it. And then second place, a little smaller, was Qt, which is a graphics framework library I haven't used myself. And then all the way up, you know, like in 7th, 10th place was the STL. And that's really funny, because if you're using Boost, that almost certainly implies that you're using the STL. So I think that developers aren't even aware that they're using the standard library, or if they are, they consider it something slightly different than the STL, which is the pre-standard library. There's even some people going around who say, oh yeah, call it the standard library, not the STL, because the STL was the thing that Stepanov did back in 1994, and it no longer exists. And yeah, you know, you can say that's technically correct, but in practice, everyone just refers to it as the part of the standard library that was derived from Stepanov's work as the STL. So what I do is I maintain the C++ standard library. I'm Microsoft's only developer doing that. We licensed its implementation from a third-party company called Dinkumware, headed by PJ Plauger, who wrote all of the C++ standard library that we use, and they continue to maintain it. We work with them. So on Microsoft's side, I see all the bugs coming in. I make sure that we're doing Microsoft-specific things correctly, like being compilable under /CLR, dealing with crazy calling conventions. That's one of my pet peeves, but I get to work on that. Doing things to integrate with the IDE, like data structure visualizers, that sort of thing. So I'm just sort of, I do little bits and pieces here and there. I get to see the implementation of the STL, and I know more about it than almost anyone else at Microsoft. But I occupy this sort of interesting position where I didn't actually write most of the code there.
Interesting.
So that's sort of just a day in my life of developing. So,
but I mean, in some sense, though, you do understand, and in some sense, you want to ensure that whatever is there is done efficiently.
Oh, absolutely.
Whether it's calling, you know, some of the new APIs that are in there, or the new ways you guys deal with pointers in some cases.
Taking advantage of new language features.
Yes.
That's a big thing for
us. You want to ensure efficiency.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the idea behind, when I think of an algorithm.
There's a pretty funny story here.
Talk to me.
In Visual Studio 2010, or VC 10.
Yes.
Because 10 is the version of Visual C++. Yeah, well, the funny thing, digression,
what the hell
about 10 is the new 6.
Come on, man.
Our PMs started running around saying, hey, 10 is the new 6, and that's sort of our unofficial slogan.
Okay.
And it's for the IDE, right? The idea that VC6 had a really fast IDE that did everything that people wanted.
Sure.
And that 10 was going to be going back to the basics.
Good.
And being really fast, really targeted for C++, blah, blah, blah.
And it is.
Yeah.
So congratulations on that.
There's lots of people saying, wow, you know, this is the best IDE that I've used in a while. But as far as the compiler and libraries go, 10 is the new 6 is completely inappropriate because 6's compiler and libraries were completely non-conformant, full of bugs, just inefficient and terrible and pre-standard. Uh-huh. And we've actually been getting better with each major version. Like 7.1 was a big step up from 6. 8 was a big step up from 7.1. So my unofficial slogan is 10 is bigger than 9. Better than 9. And so in Visual Studio 2010, one of the language features, which we've talked about before, that we implemented is called R-Value References.
Yes.
It enables move semantics, which addresses C++'s biggest problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a very, very efficient language. But one of the things that C++ likes to do a little too much is copy objects. If I have a string and I pass it to a function by value, or especially if I return it by value, that's a copy. And it's going to allocate memory for the new copy, copy over all the bytes inside the string, and then go free the old copy. And sometimes you want that. Other times, you copy something only to destroy the original. And that's actually quite inefficient. So what this new language feature, R-Value References, that enables move semantics does, is it lets the program and the library say, hey, I am going to copy from something, and the source is a temporary. So I don't actually need to do a copy. I'm just going to move it from point A to point B, and that's just a pointer twiddle. We set the pointer, we null out this other pointer, and we're done. And computers love doing that. They don't like copying bytes. They love just assigning a pointer.
Okay.
And that can make things very efficient. So recently, in fact, just this weekend, I saw a post on the Boost mailing list. A developer said that they're working on their employer does something for 4G mobile applications where they're using one of the Boost geometry libraries to figure out the coverage patterns of cell phone antennas and optimize their beam patterns to get the greatest amount of coverage. And so they're using this Boost geometry library, and then they upgraded. They usually build with Visual Studio 2008. They upgraded to 2010, and they saw a 900% performance improvement. Yeah, and the funny thing
Amazing.
Was, he actually said in this mail that everyone in the office was completely baffled and couldn't explain it, and the algorithm was still correct. So it's not like we were just saying, oh, the result is zero and just throwing everything on the floor. We were doing everything correctly, and it was 900% faster.
Insane.
And they had no idea what was causing it. But of course, it was R-Value References. There was nothing else we did in 2010 that could possibly cause that performance improvement. And the best part is, they got it for free. They just upgraded, and bam, everything was faster because we did so much work in 2010 to make that sort of thing
now
faster.
Let's talk about that because let's dig into some of the efficiencies behind R-Value References. And if we can, I mean, I don't know if there's a lot of IP that we're worried about.
Oh, no. The best thing about what I work on is that the stuff that we're supposed to implement is all specified by an international standard.
Beautiful.
So, and in fact, not only that, but many of the implementations of things that we do are obvious. And the best part is we ship all of our code in headers.
Okay.
There's like some of the floating point stuff we do in the CRT is source files that are compiled into objects. You wouldn't want to look at that anyways. But like all the algorithms, the headers, like when you include algorithm.
Yeah.
This is just a source file, and in fact, you can just open it up directly and see the implementation. Now, of course, it's full of high-powered machinery. Mm-hmm. It's ugly to look at, just as an aside. One of the things we do is if we've got, say, some helper some function like sort that's defined in algorithm, this would be std sort. If we need to call any helper functions, they would actually not be called like this. We would, I'm not sure if this is actually one in there. I'd have to go look it up in the source. But any helper functions have to be named like this, an underscore and then a capital. And the reason why we do that is these sorts of names are reserved for the compiler and the standard library. So if a user goes and macroizes any identifiers, they won't stomp on us and vice versa. We won't stomp on them.
Sure.
So as long as people don't use underscore capital names like the standard library does, we're good. Now, of course, one of the things people do is they go in our headers and they start copy-pasting code. or they'll start imitating our conventions. And that's actually bad. The whole reason we use this convention is so that we don't stomp on them and vice versa. So the standard library imitation can be hard to read, especially if you're not used to that sort of machinery.
Mm-hmm.
But on another sense, it's actually saying exactly what it does, and you can see everything that it's doing, which is pretty unusual. Like, if I want to call, you know, the Windows API heap alloc, I don't know what it's doing. I can't look at the source code.
Mm-hmm.
But with the algorithm header, I can debug into the STL and see actually what it's doing.
Excellent.
So that's it makes us a little more transparent than usual.
Perfect.
And so the cool thing about the STL, Standard Template Library, is that it has not only a ton of algorithms in this header algorithm, which says what it does, but also a ton of data structures. What I like to say is that the STL has thought longer and more deeply about data structures and algorithms than basically any other library you're going to see in any other standard library that comes with any other language.
Okay.
In fact, it's so overwhelming to new programmers sometimes that they're just paralyzed by choice. And I mean, this is a reasonable thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, when you're shopping for a new computer or a new cell phone or something, and you see like 100 options, you're like, I don't know which one to pick. And if you're looking for an algorithm or a data structure, and you see literally over 100 different types of algorithms and 10 different types of data structures, you'd be like, I don't know which one's right for my application. So it does take a little learning, a little time to get used to just the diversity of choices that the STL offers.
Sure.
Because in other languages, it's like, hey, you're going to have a dictionary, and you can have a dictionary, and that's it. You can have any color you like so long as it's black. With the STL, you can have any color you want, including like plaid.
Okay.
So the STL is not only concerned about absolute efficiency, but also about asymptotic complexity. And these are really two sides of the same coin. It's targeting both. And usually there's a trade-off. The STL pretty much manages to get both of them. So in terms of absolute efficiency, the wonderful thing about the STL is it all exists in headers. So if I include algorithm, or if I include vector, I'm getting header-only code. And when I instantiate it for my own data types, for example, say I have a vector of, I'm working on some arbitrary type, blah. When I say this, I'm instantiating a template, and that's all happening at compile time.
Okay.
So the compiler can see the whole implementation of vector, and then if I go sort this, say it's called v, if I say sort, I can't spell sort, v begin, v end. The great thing is that not only is vector's implementation visible, but also sort's implementation is being instantiated right then and there. So you can think of it as just a bunch of template magic that happens. And when it all gets expanded by the compiler, it's as if you had written the sort algorithm directly. So if the code to compare blahs is very small, it will be inlined right then and there. And this is a major advantage that the STL has over things like qsort in the C standard library. Qsort takes a function pointer. But traditionally, compilers have not been able to optimize through function pointers. Sometimes they can, but often that's a brick wall to inlining. And when you get inlining, especially for cheap things like comparators, the STL can actually be faster than the equivalent C code. So that's the STL's focus on absolute efficiency. In fact, the funny thing is many libraries rely very heavily on virtual functions and inheritance, and they're very powerful for things that happen at runtime. But when you're doing everything at compile time, you can avoid virtual functions entirely and get full inlining. And that's very much the philosophy of at least the thing that I consider the STL. Then there's this whole IO streams thing in the standard library. That's got lots of virtual functions. But when you're working just with the algorithms and core data structures, everything is really templates, header-only code, that sort of thing.
And static.
And, well, static in the sense of being compiled into your binary, not necessarily the keyword.
Oh, yeah, of course. Static. That's what I mean. Yeah, definitely nothing to do with
that. The great thing about
static versus dynamic.
There's so many keywords and so many concepts. Like if you say set, are you talking about just the mathematical idea of a set? Or are you talking about std set? I often run this problem with the new class function. There's in C++ OX, the new C++ standard, there's something called std function. The problem is that function is an ordinary word, too. So I usually have to say std double colon function in order to make it clear what I'm talking about.
Now, in that case, what you're talking about is what?
So the neat thing about function is this can be very useful when you're writing algorithms, is that function is very special. And This is something that's actually quite difficult to write by hand in full generality. The other great thing about the STL is that we write the code, so you don't have to. So if you have a std function, say I'm going to make it int, it looks like this.
Okay.
F. So what f is it's a wrapper around a function that takes an int and returns an int.
Mm-hmm.
And this can be given anything. It can be given function pointers. It can be given function objects. It can be given lambdas. This is the new feature in 2010.
Yes.
It can even be given things like bound function objects and so forth. And all you do is you say, like, f is a lambda that is going to take an int n and return n times 5. And you can assign or construct this std function with anything that's really callable, including not just lambdas, but also plain old functions and traditional function objects.
Mm.
And what's happening here is a cute little trick. This function object here, this lambda, is some unspecified type whose type you can't even mention. And when you assign it to a std function, it forgets the type, but it remembers the signature, taking an int and returning an int. And then later on, you can go call this without even knowing that it was constructed or assigned from this lambda.
Hmm.
And so this sort of bit of type forgetting or type erasure is very clever and very difficult to write by yourself in full generality.
Hmm.
But it can allow you to, say, separately compile something that takes some arbitrary std function, and then later someone else can decide what to call it with.
Hmm.
And this fits with the mix and match philosophy of the STL. And this is the other thing that distinguishes C++'s STL from other libraries, is that it's ridiculously customizable, but it doesn't force you to make all of those choices. So like if I'm sorting a vector,
mm-hmm.
By default, it compares things with less than. So if x is less than y, mm-hmm. so if I'm sorting a vector of ints, I could end up with 1, 2, 2, 2, you know, 4, 6, 10, something like that. And so every element is either less than or equal to the element that succeeds it. But I'm not restricted into using less than. I can give it the opposite comparator. If I call std sort vbegin, vend, and I say greater of int, now I can sort my vector in reverse. So I would end up with 10, 6, 4, 2, 2, 2, 1.
Okay.
So std sort doesn't care how it's comparing elements. That can be customized, and it doesn't even care what elements it's operating on. Sort works equally well with ints, strings, arbitrary objects, other STL data structures. You could have a vector of vectors. Sort just doesn't care. Mm. It's written in a completely general manner, and it's also efficient even if you're working with things like vectors or strings, as long as they participate in move semantics now with 2010. Previously, we had some hacks, which I won't go into. Not really hacks, but sort of workarounds that were brittle and not completely general. And in 2010, that's all removed, replaced with move semantics. And now we can take advantage of that, even if it's a user-defined type, as long as you give it a move constructor and a move
semantic. So is sort taking advantage of the R-value reference?
It is, internally. So if you look at what sort has to do, say I start off with a vector.
Wow.
So if I've got a vector v, v really contains 3 pointers.
Memory.
Yeah, and suppose that I have so this is a vector of string. Okay, these pointers point to this and like this. So if I have a vector of strings, each of these strings, I won't go into their representation, but you can think of them as just pointers to strings somewhere in memory.
Okay.
This could be like, you know, foo, bar, and so forth, up to meow. And when we sort this vector of strings, we have to swap elements. So if we're sorting this alphabetically, bar has to come before foo. So what previously, if you wrote this completely naively, what we would have to do is we would have to copy bar into temporary memory. So create a copy of bar here, and then copy this over here, the other way around. We would have to copy foo over here, and then copy bar over here, and then destroy this. So lots and lots of memory copying. That's actually pretty inefficient.
Mm-hmm.
Now with either the clever imitations that we did in 2008 or the new move semantics machinery, we had foo here, we had bar here. All that we do is we store an extra pointer to bar, and then we end up, actually, it'd probably be easier if I just show it like this, ignoring the temporary. All that we do is we swap the pointers. So we say, yoink, yoink. And so bar is here, foo is here, and we didn't actually move these blocks of memory. Mm. Now, when the strings are just three characters, it looks pretty inexpensive, but you could imagine these strings could be URLs, paths, long strings that could be like a kilobyte or more, mm-hmm. 10 kilobytes, and swapping that could be actually quite expensive. Whereas if we swap just the pointers, it can be very efficient. And
sure.
Now we do that for free in the sense of every ESTA object has the move semantics enabled, and users can easily write their own member functions that do that. Now, one of the things that they just voted into the C++ OX working paper is a specification that allows move constructors and move assignment operators to be automatically generated for classes as long as they obey certain patterns. That hasn't been implemented yet. It was literally voted into the working paper as we released Visual Studio 2010.
Okay.
But eventually we'll get that. And it'll be completely backwards compatible in the sense that sometimes we'll just start automatically benefiting from move constructors. So that's one of the things that the STL does for just absolute efficiency, avoiding these unnecessary copies. But the other great thing about the STL is that it really focuses on asymptotic complexity. And this is sort of one of my pet peeves. When people try to write their own data structures, they'll often ignore what happens when the number of elements increases. So imagine that I'm writing a flexible array. I'm going to call it FlexArray. Okay. And I'm just going to give it a pointer and a length and then a capacity. So if I am constructed, say, with 100 elements, so the length of this is 100. The length could say 100, and the capacity could say 100.
Okay.
Now, what happens if I add an extra element? This is a flex array, so I'm not restricted to a set amount of elements at compile time. If I add another element, and one of my guarantees in my flex array is that all elements are contiguous, well, I ran out of memory. So I need to allocate new memory. I'll need to copy my existing elements over and then repoint my pointer. Mm-hmm. But the question here is, how many elements do I allocate? And for some reason, when programmers are doing this by themselves, their first impulse is to add a fixed number of elements. Often the favorite number seems to be 10, sometimes 1,000. Imagine that it's 10. I would end up allocating 110 elements, and I would copy over my existing 100. I'd add in the new element here, and then I have slack space for 9 elements, so my length would be 110 now, or sorry, my length would be 101, and my capacity would be up to 110. This is cool, right? Because we're avoiding consuming extra memory. Actually, it's not cool.
Because yeah, no, it's not.
If you add a constant number of elements and you insert n elements, the total amount of time that your program will spend is n squared, quadratic complexity. Mm. And that's because you have to copy all elements over. So if you think about just pushing back a single element at a time, we have to copy 100 elements. And then when you get up to 110, we have to copy 110 elements. And then we have to copy 120, and so forth. And if you add all of this up, it ends up being proportional to n squared.
Sure.
N squared is an extremely bad complexity. If If people have taken computer science and haven't slept through all the courses, they'll know this sort of intuitively. But not all programmers go through a computer science education.
Yes.
They'll go through engineering or they'll just learn on the job.
Or they'll go through math.
Yeah, or they'll go through math. And these just focus on different things.
Sure.
So they can be excellent in the areas that they're working on. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to things like algorithms, which are very much computer science's domain, mm-hmm. Things like asymptotic complexity are sort of lost to them. Once I brought this up in a meeting, and one of the testers said, "What's that O notation that you're using?" And he just hadn't been exposed to it. And that's cool. Yeah. But when you're working on algorithms, you really want to at least consult with someone who knows this sort of thing. So the bad thing about quadratic complexity is that it ends up leading to programs that hit a brick wall. So if I'm processing email messages, well, say that I've got some search that's proportional to n squared, number of messages in my inbox. That may be fine when n is 100, because 100 squared is just 10,000. Mm-hmm. But what if I have 1,000 messages in my inbox? Now it's proportional to 1,000,000. Mm-hmm. What if I'm one of those people who keeps everything in their inbox, and now my inbox is 10,000 messages? Mm-hmm. Hey, why is my computer locking up?
Yes.
That sort of thing. All because of this poor choice of this very, very small thing in this data structure. Now, what the STL does is, of course, it says this is unthinkable.
Yeah.
So here it's not called flex array, it's called vector. People sometimes say, oh, vector doesn't really say what it does. Maybe it should be called something like dyn array or flex array, but that's just the name that it has. And when it decides to grow, the C++ standard actually mandates that it not grow by some constant factor, but that it grow by a multiplicative factor. So if my length is initially 100 and I insert an element, it must grow proportionally. And the constant that we choose in our implementation is 1.5. So we would actually allocate 150 elements, copy them all over. And if you work out the math, this is really a classic computer science question. As long as you're allocating something like times 1.5 or times 2 or any fixed multiplicative factor, then the amount of time that inserting n elements one by one will take is actually linear.
Mm-hmm.
It's called amortized constant time per insertion. So every once in a while, an insertion will be a little slower than usual because you've got to copy all of these elements. But if you work it out, there's a constant number of times that elements will be copied because you're just getting larger and larger blocks. So in one sense, someone who's new to this sort of analysis would say, whoa, why are you allocating so much memory? You're wasting space and, won't this be less efficient? But it's actually more efficient. It's actually so efficient that vector is sort of the data structure first resort. If you don't know what data structure you want a vector. Because it's insanely efficient, not just in terms of asymptotic complexity, but also because it's contiguous. Hmm. And this is, again, the STL's focus on both absolute and asymptotic efficiency. Processors love elements that are contiguous in memory. If you're iterating through a vector, processors love seeing them right next to memory, one after another, because they can cache it. So once you're reading the 100th element, it can already load the 100th and first into the cache. Whereas if you've got a data structure like a linked list, which the STL also has, I'm drawing them next to each other, but they could actually be anywhere in memory. So, and I don't know where this element is until I've read this pointer here. So processors, they're okay with this sort of traversal pattern, but having everything be contiguous in memory is not only more space efficient, it's more time efficient.
Absolutely.
So that's one of the reasons why vector is great if you don't know what data structure you want. Mm. So vector is, let me just draw a little nice and contiguous. And then this is one of the things that always trips up newcomers to the C++ standard library is they often say, I want a list of elements, because they're just thinking in English terms. And they're like, oh, look, std list, this is what I want. And they actually don't want std list most of the time, because list is actually a doubly linked list. And I believe that .NET has introduced further confusion because their iList is actually random access.
Hmm.
The STL uses list to mean a doubly linked list. And the reason why you would ever want to choose a doubly linked list is because it's more efficient when you want to insert an element into the middle. So if I'm inserting an element into the middle of a vector, this is often not very good in terms of asymptotic complexity, because in order to keep everything contiguous, I need to move all the elements from the midpoint to the end of the vector down by one and then insert my new element. So if I'm doing that a lot, I could get back quadratic complexity. That's bad. Whereas with list, if I want to insert an element in the middle, all I do is I allocate a new node, I do some pointer surgery to grafted in here, and none of the other elements change.
Okay.
So I've actually never had to use StudList myself. This is funny. And all the programs that I've written, you know, except for test programs and demo programs, I've never come across a case where you actually need to be able to insert things into the middle. But if you do, StudList is there, and it works with the rest of the STL algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's an oddball data structure called DEC that I won't go into. But what it supports is it's a doubly-ended queue. And it supports not only random access, so I can access the fifth element here if I want, but I can push things not only to the back, which Vector supports, but also on the front.
Hmm.
This is actually a very clever data structure, and it's I've used it once or twice. When you need to do something like push things to the front and then yet random access things inside. List supports not only insertions in the middle, but insertions to the front and back. You just add new nodes. But it's not random access.
Mm.
If I want to find the fifth element in a list, I can't do that efficiently without stepping. DEC is sort of a hybrid between vector and list, and it can be pretty useful. The other sort of workhorses of the STL are set and map. Map is an excellent data structure, and the only unfortunate thing is that it doesn't have hash in the name. Programmers coming from other languages often say, I want a hash table, because that's what their old languages support. Mm. The STL's associative container is actually not powered by hashes. So if I have a map, say, from int to string, I can say m of 5 equals meow. I do love cats. And then m of 6 equals cat. This looks very much like usage in other languages, but what this is actually constructing is a tree. So it's a binary tree. And every node of the tree has a pair, one part of which is an int, and the other part of which is a string, in this case. And it's ordered by the key. So this would be the key K and then the value type V.
Okay.
And the thing about map is that it has logarithmic complexity for most operations. So if I want to look up something, well, this tree is a binary tree. So in order to find a leaf, I only have to spend order log n time looking it up. And if I want to insert a node, I need to find where to insert it. And then I do rebalancing of the tree. And again, that takes order log n. It's a classic computer science data structure. And it's also a classic example of something you would never, ever want to write yourself. You can look at the math header if you want. But the code to mark nodes as red and black and to rotate them around is horrible. It's terrible to write. It's easy to get wrong. So this is one of the great things to put in a standard library. So its implementation is terrible, but it's terrible to look at. Mm-hmm. But its use is very simple. And it can be plugged into STL algorithms very easily.
Excellent.
What I like to say is when you're writing an algorithm, mm-hmm. you need to have the right sort of fundamental building blocks. And once you have those, then you can achieve most things simply by putting them together properly.
Mm-hmm.
I found just writing my own programs that just throwing vector and map and also the occasional set and list and things like that, you know, DEC, I've never used list myself, combined with STL algorithms can achieve maybe 95% of things that I need to do. Then there's other algorithms that you need, but those can often be treated as black boxes that you can get from a library. Like if you need a cryptographic hash, you just find some library that implements, say, SHA 256, and you're done. You can just treat it as, I've got a black box, in goes data, out goes hash. And you don't need to know anything that goes on the inside. Whereas with something like vector and map, I mean, you don't really need to know their implementations, but it is almost critically important that you at least know the vague outlines of their implementation. That vector is sequential, that it's contiguous, that inserting in the middle will cause this reallocation at the end. And the STL will help you, but it can't help you if you don't know the first thing about any of these data structures.
So let's talk really briefly about in this world that we live in with, you know, the approaching many-core doomsday, which of course it's not a doomsday, I mean, obviously.
Yeah.
But what data structure would you use to take advantage of 12 cores simultaneously to operate on some, or have like a flexible array that you're operating on?
Well, one of the things that are, so we've got all these acronyms. There's the parallel computing platform.
Yes.
That consists of the concurrency runtime.
Yep.
Or concert. And the Parallel Patterns Library, which I pronounce people and no one else seems to. One of the things about the Parallel Patterns Library is not only do they have parallel algorithms like Parallel 4 and Parallel 4 each and things like that, but they also come with a couple of data structures called Concurrent Vector. And I believe Concurrent Queue, but Concurrent Vector is the interesting one that I've used. So one of the things about the STL is it provides what I call the usual thread safety guarantee. So if I have a std vector somewhere in memory, you know, this is just a triple of pointers that points to stuff. And one of the things I can do is I can have multiple threads simultaneously read this vector. So if I just want to say I want the element and via 5, I want the vector size. These are all reads. They don't modify the data structure in any way. So it's completely safe for multiple threads to be doing this simultaneously. But if I have a single thread that could potentially modify this, say a V pushback, then it is unsafe for any other thread to be reading or writing that vector. They could end up seeing the vector in a temporarily inconsistent state, or doing multiple writes to a single vector could end up crashing the program. And I call this the usual thread safety guarantee because it's sort of the guarantee that you get for free. Vector doesn't contain any locks whatsoever in release mode. And when data structures don't contain locks, this is what you get. And you certainly wouldn't want every member function, every operation on the vector to be locked, because not only would that be a horrible waste of time, but it also wouldn't get you correctness. Usually your locks need to be above the level of individual member function calls. So vector is very good for single-threaded programs and for programs where they may be multi-threaded, but you don't have multiple threads partying on a single data structure. When you do, you either need to take locks or you need to resort to a data structure that is meant for concurrency, and concurrent vector is one of those. So the big thing that concurrent vector does not guarantee is it doesn't guarantee contiguity. What it looks like, and this implementation was actually explained to me by one of the concert developers, is that it actually looks like a list of, it actually kind of resembles a deck. So this might contain 2 elements, this might contain 4. So it is flexible, but as it adds more and more space, it's simply allocating new blocks of memory. And these are all disjoint. So you can't get, if you have a concurrent vector, you're not guaranteed that address address V0 plus 5 equals address via 5. This is true for std vector, but it's not true for concurrent vector, because they could be in these different chunks. But in exchange for giving up the guarantee of contiguity, which also decreases a little performance as you're just iterating straight through, you gain a new guarantee, and that's it's okay for multiple threads to be simultaneously pushing back different data. So if I have thread A that's potentially pushing back some elements, I could have thread B also pushing back some elements, and I'll get them in some unspecified order. So I could get A and B, or I could get, you know, a B and then A, but they're not going to corrupt the data structure. And then once all my threads are done, I can read the data structure straight through and sort it or whatever I want. Now, of course, I'm saying threads, but when you're using concert and people, you really aren't thinking in terms of threads. You're thinking in terms
of tasks
and parallel algorithms like parallel for
Absolutely.
Each. Underneath the covers, it's all implemented by
threads. Of course.
That's a convenient thing to talk about. But you're actually working at a very high level. So, and this complements the STL, because not only are the algorithms imitating the STL, but they can also be used with STL objects, and especially with lambdas. So they all sort of fit together. Lambdas work with both the Parallel Patterns Library and with the STL. So if you're used to using them in one, you can pretty easily switch over to using them with another. And they're working in separate domains. You certainly wouldn't want to use a concurrent vector for everything that you're doing, because it doesn't support operations like erasure in the middle and that sort of thing in a thread-safe manner. Whereas if you're using a std vector, then you can erase in the middle as long as you're aware that you can't do that simultaneously on other threads.
So let me ask you a question. I mean, what if somebody maybe naively created using a parallel for each, updating of standard vector and not a concurrent vector?
Parallel for each is okay on a std vector. So concurrent vectors needed when you've got multiple threads that are generating results and you need to collect them all. You could also use a combinable, but concurrent vector often tends to be very convenient. The thing about parallel for each is I could say parallel for each on a std vector.
Yep.
And it's got a bunch of elements.
Mm-hmm.
What parallel for each will do is we'll parcel out chunks of the vector to different tasks operating potentially on different threads, different cores, but they're all going to be operating on different parts of the vector. So imagine that I've got a quad core and the parallel patterns library decides that other stuff is going on, so I can use three of the cores right now.
Okay.
It would chop this vector up in thirds, and the first third of the vector would all be processed, you know, element by element, and the second third and the other third. But because it's not resizing the data structure, it's only operating on individual elements, this is completely safe.
Hmm.
So as long as the operation that I'm doing doesn't access any sort of global state or static state, it's perfectly okay for me to be operating on this element A and this element B and this element C simultaneously. The vector doesn't care. It's over here. It's a triple of pointers. It's not being modified in any way. So as long as the elements can cope with being modified simultaneously, different elements. So as long as they're not referencing some shared global state, it's completely cool.
And it's contiguous.
And in this case, it happens to be contiguous, but it would work fine if it was a std deck or even a std list. So one of the interesting things that Concert does is this parallel for each is specified as taking forward or better iterators. So a little bit about the iterator categories. You've got input iterators. You've got forward iterators. You've got bidirectional, and you've got random access. In the STL, we abbreviate these to like bidi and ranit access.
Okay.
And then you've also got output here. Looks like this. So, and then you can think of having an even more powerful category down here called contiguous. The STL doesn't formalize this, but implementation-wise, we often want to detect this. So things that, iterators that are random access can be used to say, oh, I want the fifth element in constant time. Iterator operations really have to be constant time because they're multiplied by n, the number of elements. So imagine that I had a list, say I've got a std list.
Sure.
I could implement random access iterators that would allow me to get, say, to the third element. But they could only do that by hopping from the first to the second to the third. So if accessing an element is order of n, and I do something n times, say I'm operating on every element of the list, hey, I've got n squared again. That's really bad. So what the STL does is say I'm only going to provide operations that are efficient, and this could cause iterators to be weaker powered, but that's okay, because that's really the power of the data structure that they're exposing. So things like vector are random access. It's vector's actually contiguous as well. Std list is bidi. If you have a forward list, this is a singly linked list in C++ OX. That's forward. And then input iterators are things like iStream iterators that you can see the input once, but it's not being stored anywhere persistently. So if you look at parallel for each, it's specified as taking forward iterators, because if I have a singly linked list like this, I can chop this up.
Okay.
Now, what parallel for each does internally is it recognizes when you're giving it something like a vector. So if I've got a vector that's nice and contiguous, parallel for each can split this up in constant time. Say I detect that, I can use four cores. Mm-hmm. I can say I want, and say the vector is 100 elements. I'm going to pass iterators corresponding to location 0, 25, 50, and 75, all the way up to 100.
Mm-hmm.
And I can get iterators to these. I can query the data structure size in constant time, and then I can get iterators at these specific locations in constant time as well. And so I spend a constant amount of time chopping up the vector into fourths, and then I send them off to my different tasks operating on different threads, and I get essentially linear speed up, assuming that everything else doesn't have bottlenecks.
Sure.
Now, if I call parallel for each with either a forward list or a std list, something that's node-based, mm-hmm. I can't chop up the data structure immediately in constant time. I do have to traverse. So I've got a single thread, in this case it really is a thread, that's hopping along each node, and once I find, oh, the data structure contains 100 elements, and I've taken 25 hops, mm-hmm. I'm going to send this off to one task. I'm going to keep hopping along nodes and spin up other tasks as I reach more and more nodes. I don't get quite a linear speed up in terms of the number of cores, but I still get a speed up because I can have the first task operating on a good chunk of elements before sending another task to go process another chunk of elements. And internally, parallel for each detects all of this by overloading helper functions on the power of iterators. So this is actually a pretty fancy trick that the STL uses. If you have an iterator, imagine that I've got template, type name. And the funny thing is, I had recently read a white paper by Herb Sutter, who was talking about evolving iterator categories. And one of the bullet points in his paper was that you couldn't do this trick that I'm about to show you.
Okay.
But in the STL implementer world, which is what I live in, yeah. this trick is just second nature to us.
Okay.
So I guess it's not as widely known as it really ought to be. And so, of course, I told Herb, hey, we can actually do this thing. You said it was impossible. And he was like, oh, that's cool. So I've got a template type name, forward it, and, you know, some return, and then parallel for each, or, you know, my algorithm. So my algorithm.
Okay. And this will be the final thing that we jump into.
Okay. That takes forward it first. Forward it. So if I'm just writing this naively, the only operations that I can do on these forward iterators are increment them, dereference them, compare them, do a couple other things. But okay. if I'm in here, I can't say pre-decrement first, because that would be attempting to go to a previous element, and forward iterators only let you go forward. I certainly can't say something like first plus n. So these are both no. But what if I have two implementations of an algorithm, one that works for forward iterators and one that's more efficient for either bidirectional or random access iterators? And a good example of this is partition. Imagine that I've got a sequence of elements, say, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and I want to partition all of the odd numbers before all of the even numbers. Well, if I have bidirectional iterators, I can do this with n over 2 swaps, and this is actual n over 2, not asymptotic, by having one iterator start at the beginning, having one iterator start at the end, and they simply swap when they detect that they have an element that doesn't belong where it is.
Okay.
And it turns out, and this is actually implemented in the STL, I'm just using it as an example, it turns out that works as long as you have a bidirectional container, but if you have a forward container that looks like this, you can do it with n swap, so it's half as efficient, but it's still possible by starting two iterators at the beginning and stepping them forward, and one will get farther than the other, and they'll start swapping elements between them whenever they detect, oh, I found one that's out of place, I'm going to go swap it back to this earlier one.
Cool.
So it's half as efficient, but it's still possible. So if you want to implement something like that, what you do is you say, my algo, and it takes two forward iterators. And then what you do is you say, you call an internal helper function, go helper, first, last, and then you say, std iterator traits, forward it. Iterator category, right. So what this does is, this is a template that, given an iterator type, will return a tag, which is just an empty struct. It only exists for the purposes of its type, that says how powerful the iterator is. And it, the STL defines bidirectional iterator tag, random access iterator tag, And all of the STL iterators are tagged appropriately with this. If you're writing a custom iterator, which is something that's pretty rare, but people do it from time to time, especially libraries like Boost, one of the first steps you have to take is appropriately tagging your iterator with this level of power, because we can't deduce it otherwise without C++ or X.
Tag your iterator, bro.
So once it's appropriately tagged, you can define a MyAlgo helper that looks like template, type name, forward it, blah, blah, blah. That takes forward it first, forward it last, and then something like bidirectional, I'm going to abbreviate, iterator tag. So this is a type. It's just an empty struct. I could give this parameter an actual name, but I'm not going to refer to it in any way. So I'm just going to make it a nameless parameter. This trick can also be confusing when you first see it. So then I'll implement the efficient version of my algorithm that does n over 2 swaps or whatever. And then, that's a brace. And then I'll define a second helper, my algo helper, that again is template type me forward it first, forward it last,
okay,
and is overloaded on forward iterator, again abbreviating, iterator tag. And this does the less efficient, but hey, it still gets done, and swaps. And what happens here is if you call this with a very powerful iterator, it's either bidirectional or random access, this template will end up turning out to be either bidirectional iterator tag or random access iterator tag, and overload resolution will kick in and call this efficient version of the algorithm. If you call it with a weaker forward iterator, then overload resolution will say, I can't actually access this one, but hey, I'm still a forward iterator, so it'll end up detecting this, and it all happens at compile time, which is very powerful.
Interesting.
And so this trick allows you to overload your algorithm on the most efficient possible version for whatever you're being given. And we use this everywhere in the STL, and now the Parallel Patterns Library uses it as well.
Excellent.
So people who are writing very generic algorithms can take advantage of this, and if you don't, you can simply call STL algorithms, and they'll do all of this behind the scenes for you.
Perfect.
So that sort of thing is very nice.
Amazing. Well, hey, thanks for coming in today and talking about this. I mean, it seems like every time we talk to you, we learn, like, I don't know, 20 or 30 new things. Excellent job. And, you know, because Visual Studio 2010 was just launched and we were, you know, we had a session down in Las Vegas, we talked about native code. So there's a lot of investment that's been made for native developers in this latest release. So there's your marketing thing. Hey, man, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for talking.
Great job.